Lord willing, and if Jesus tarries another hour or so, we will finish up the Christian's relationship to the Old Testament study. I think this is the seventh one, if I have counted right. And we are going through the objections section. If you remember from last time, we covered the first three, and today we will cover the rest. And let's see, how many are there? There are 16, so we got a few to do, several today. All right, so the fourth objection is that the Sabbath was given in Exodus 16, 22 through 30, before it was given in the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, 8 through 11. Now, this allegedly, supposedly proves that it was not just given to Israel, that it was given before it was given in the Ten Commandments, but it really proves no such thing. Let's read both of those places, and then we'll see why it doesn't prove anything. It proves my point. It's more of an objection on our part against the Sabbatarians than it would be on their part against us. So anyway, Exodus 16, 22 through 30. This is the first place you will find here where the word Sabbath is used in the scripture. Exodus 16, 22, "And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for a man, and all the rulers of one congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, This is that which the Lord hath said, Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath." First place in the Bible where the word Sabbath is used. "Unto the Lord, bake that which ye will bake today, and seethe that which ye will seethe, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up until the morning, and as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. And Moses said, Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days ye shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. And it shall come to pass that there went out, and it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said unto Moses, How long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? See for that the Lord hath given you the Sabbath. Therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place, and let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day." So we see here the first instance of the Sabbath given, and when God was giving them manna, he gave them enough on the sixth day to last them for 2 days, and they weren't to go and gather on the seventh day, and some people did it anyway. They didn't. If you can imagine that, people not taking the Lord at his word and just have to go prove him and make sure. But anyway, this objection is made that the Sabbath was given before the Ten Commandments, and that this somehow proves that this is like some universal Sabbath commandment or something that wasn't given in the Law of Moses. Now let me ask you, is Exodus a book of the Law of Moses? Yeah, it's in the Law of Moses, right? It's actually the same book where the Ten Commandments are given. These were commandments of Moses. This is all part of the Law of Moses. So this objection makes no sense whatsoever. I'm not even going to read Exodus 28 through 11. That's where it's given in the Ten Commandments. You see, this is given to Israel in both places. And the thing is, it was only ever given to Israel. And we looked at that last time, Exodus 31. And I won't read that one either because we've read it before. But he says that this is a covenant between me and the children of Israel forever. So I don't know. I just threw this objection in there because I heard it from somebody. I think it's probably the weakest one I've ever heard. Okay, the next objection, number 5. Jesus kept the Sabbath. You've probably heard this one before. Well, if Jesus kept it, then we ought to keep it, right? Of course. Well, of course he did. Of course Jesus kept the Sabbath. Why? Because he was a Jew living under the Law of Moses. It was not abolished at that point. If he wouldn't have kept the Sabbath, we'd all be in hell. So you better be thankful that he kept the Sabbath. He had to keep the Sabbath. He was a Jew. He also kept the Jewish feasts and the rest of the Law of Moses perfectly. That's how he could save us. He kept the law for us because we had all broken it. Jesus fulfilled and abolished the Law of Moses. And we've looked at these verses already. Matthew 5:17, he said, "Think not that I've come to destroy the law and the prophets, but to abolish them." So he came to abolish them, and we are told in 2 Corinthians 3, and I've read these verses so many times, I'll tell you what, I'm going to read it one more time, and then I'm going to refer to it every other time in the rest of this study. So turn one last time. It's the last time you're going to hear me read this set of verses here for a while. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 7. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 7, 11 and 13. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 says, "Who also hath made us able ministers of the New Testament, not of the letter, but of the Spirit." The letter is that Old Testament. The Spirit's the New Testament. "For the letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life." Remember, the law demanded your death if you didn't keep it. The letter killeth, but the Spirit giveth life. Jesus raises us from the dead, spiritually and physically. "But if the ministration of death, written and graven in stones," that's the Ten Commandments, written on stones by the finger of God, "was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance, which glory was to be done away." We read about that in Exodus 34. When he came down off the mountain, his face was shining. He's carrying the Ten Commandments with him. We know what this is talking about. Verse 11. "For if that which is done away," still talking about this Ten Commandments, law of Moses, "it is done away, was glorious, much more that which remaineth is glorious. Seeing then that we have such hope, we use great plainness of speech, and not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished." It is done away, it is abolished. I've said this probably a dozen times in this series. And that's the last time I'm going to read that passage, and I will refer back to it again. So Jesus fulfilled and abolished, which means the same thing. We've already defined those terms in the past. He fulfilled and abolished the law of Moses, and which that includes the Sabbath. Turn us to Colossians 2, 14 through 17. And we've been over this verse plenty of times too, but I will at least make one more reference to it. Colossians 2, 14 through 17. It says, "Blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. And having spoiled principalities and powers, he made a show of them openly, triumphing over them in it. Let no man therefore judge you in meat, or in drink, or in respect of an holy day, or of the new moon, or of the Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. Because Christ nailed that Old Testament to the cross and took it out of the way, therefore don't let anybody judge you about keeping any of those laws of Moses, like meats and drinks, like holy days, like new moons, like Sabbaths, like any of that stuff. It's all put away. Christ kept it for us. It was a shadow and a picture of him. So that's why he kept the Sabbath. All right, objection number six. Paul kept the Sabbath. You probably heard this one, right? Because we've read in this study where Paul would go into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and he would dispute with the Jews and so on. So yeah, Paul kept the Sabbath. But we've already covered why he did. Because Paul was a Jew, and during that transitional period from 33 to 70 AD, until the destruction of Jerusalem, when the temple was destroyed, the Jews could keep the Sabbath and they could keep parts of the law of Moses. Paul even went in, you remember, and had the vow of a Nazarite with some guys, and they shaved their heads and an offering was made in Acts 21. And you can refer back to section 7 on that transitional period. I'm not going to cover all that information again. But that's why Paul could keep the Sabbath. He was a Jew. But nowhere are Gentiles ever told to keep the Sabbath. And we've been over that information lots of times in the last several weeks. Okay, objection number 7. Moving right along. "A jot or a tittle would not pass from the law till heaven and earth pass away." Matthew 5:18. "Therefore the Ten Commandments are still in effect." Have you ever heard this one? Turn to Matthew 5:18. Matthew 5:18. This is a very common one. We'll get verses 17 and 18. "Think not that I am come to destroy the law," Jesus says, "or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law, till all be fulfilled." So they say, well, Jesus said, jot or tittle, nothing's going to pass from the law. That means that we're still under the law of Moses. And that means that we have to keep the Ten Commandments. And I'm sure you've heard that before. And the Sabbath is one of those commandments. And usually most of these guys, I mean, their issue is the Sabbath. When they start talking about keeping the law of Moses, some of them are outright, they believe that you ought to keep the whole law of Moses. There's a term for them, but anyway, legalist, I guess you would say. Judaizers, there you go. Pharisees, whatever. Lots of terms we could use. But a lot of them, it's the Sabbath. So when they say we got to keep the Ten Commandments, they are talking about the Sabbath. And of course, the rest of the Ten go in there too. So anyway, You can refer back to section 5:7 for that, where Jesus fulfilled and abolished the law, though the text of the law shall never pass away. And if you remember, we talked about that. He fulfilled the law of Moses. All of the commandments in the law of Moses were no longer under them. But the text, the actual words that we have before us, they will never pass away. They're still here. They've been here for thousands of years, and they will be here throughout all time. Jesus said that his words would never pass away. The jotter a tittle, which is the Old Testament, that wouldn't pass away. It says the words of the Lord are pure words, purified in a furnace of earth 7 times. Thou shalt keep them, O Lord. Thou shalt preserve them from this generation forever. Psalm 12, 6 and 7. So yeah, the words are never going to pass away, but God's law has changed. So a jot and a tittle won't pass away, but that does not mean we're still under the law of Moses. And 9 of the 10 commandments are repeated in the New Testament, except for the Sabbath commandment, and are therefore still in effect. And we've already covered that. And you can see that in section 7, 2, A and B. And I have a hyperlink there for you in the outline. Make it easy for you to find it. All right, here's the next objection, number 8. See, it's really easy to cover these objections once we've already laid the groundwork for 6 weeks, and then we just refer back to things we've already learned and refresh your memory. All right, here's one from a guy named Michael McLeod on YouTube. Some of these guys I actually gave credit to where credit is due. Just give the direct quote here. I'm sure they'll be happy to find out that they're in a sermon somewhere, but that's all right. I'll post a link for them, and they can read it. He says, there are still things in the Tanakh, which is the Old Covenant, that haven't been fulfilled yet, and Jesus said nothing will pass away until all is fulfilled. This is basically the same as the previous objection, but I want to cover his objection specifically. First of all, Jesus did not say that nothing will pass away until all be fulfilled. He said that a jot or a tittle will not pass away. He didn't say nothing. The law of Moses has passed away as far as us keeping it is concerned. So you got to be careful with your words there. When you start throwing out these general terms and universal language, he said that nothing will pass away. He didn't say that. He said it would be a jot or a tittle wouldn't pass away. Matthew 5:18. Like I just said, Jesus fulfilled and abolished the law, though the text of the law shall not pass away. Section 5:7. Now, parts of the Old Testament, such as unfulfilled prophecies of the second coming or other unfulfilled prophecies, historical accounts, much of the Psalms, not all of the Psalms, but much of the Psalms and the Proverbs are not abolished. And we covered that in section 7:4. But the law of Moses most definitely is, and we've already seen that in 2 Corinthians 3. So if you remember, we talked about, what about the Psalms, what about the Proverbs, what about the prophecies? Of course, prophecies are not done away with. If God predicts an event that's going to happen in the future and writes it down, because the law of Moses has now been done away with, that doesn't mean that that prophecy is not true anymore. Of course, it's still true. When God predicts in a future event, it is true, and it's written down there, and it's written down in the New Testament as well, most of those prophecies. Same with the Psalms. The parts of the Psalms that are not specific to the law of Moses are not abolished, right? There's Psalms that just talk about how good God is. Well, God, yeah, God's still good, and those Psalms are still true, right? But parts that have to do with the law of Moses, when it talks about sacrificing, when it talks about worshiping the Lord with musical instruments and things like that, that was specific to the law of Moses. It was specific to Israel's worship of God in that time, under that economy. So anything specific to Israel, specific to the law of Moses, in the Psalms, that part would be abolished, but the entirety of the Psalms is not abolished. And of course, the Proverbs are pithy sayings about life in general that generally hold true. They're sayings that just come about by observing human nature. Human nature was not abolished at the cross of Christ. Therefore, these Proverbs are all just as true today as they were back then. All right, here's the next objection. This is from a guy named Samuel Rivera on YouTube. And this objection isn't really all that wrong. There's just really one little part of it that's wrong. But I'm going to read you the whole thing anyway, and then read you the part where he had something not quite so nice to say about me anyway. I think it's just interesting to show you what people have to say. He says, I believe that there is a difference between the law of Moses found in the Pentateuch, which is the first five books of the Bible, and the entire 39 books of the Old Testament. I agree with Mr. Rivera there. You, however, have abolished it all. Now, that's obviously where he's wrong. I have not abolished it all. He didn't hear this sermon, though. So maybe from what he heard, maybe he did think that I abolished it all. But I have now clarified that, and I will post him a link to this. The Psalms are full of instruction on how we should praise and worship. I don't have an issue with that. It is full of depictions of the musical instruments that you have condemned as non-scriptural. And he's right, I have condemned them as non-scriptural. They are not in the New Testament.
That's right.
The New Testament says to sing. If God wanted us to sing in the New Testament, He had given plenty of instruction in the Old Testament about, or if He wanted, pardon me, if God wanted us to use musical instruments in the New Testament, He has shown Himself very able to put instruction about musical instruments in the Bible. He could have put it in the New Testament. It's not there.
That's right.
Not one place. All right, anyway, got to get through this guy's objection. The wisdom offered in Proverbs would be unavailable by your rules. Wrong again. He is wrong on that one. Finally, prophecy is still being fulfilled. I think he's saying prophecy is fulfilled that is in the Old Testament and complements the New, is what I think what he meant to say. Remember the questions I asked you in my first comment. Actually, I don't remember what they even were. But that's immaterial. Now, kindly look at the number of views your videos have received. I respectfully submit that when Christians see your name in a video, they are inclined to pass it by. Your efforts to abolish the Old Testament under the guise of, quote, it is the law, constitutes another law of your own making. Again, I say, I believe there is a difference between the law of Moses found in the Pentateuch and the entire 39 books of the Old Testament. So like I said, this guy wasn't really altogether wrong. There's just a couple little things that he missed. And I'm thankful for his comment because that made me go back and think, okay, well, what about the Psalms? What about the Proverbs? What about the prophecies? Really, that's why I added in that whole section there. So I'm indebted to Mr. Rivera. I appreciate his comment. Like I said, pay attention to your critics. You know, sometimes you can learn something from them. So he was correct that there is a difference between the entire 39 books and the law of Moses. We talked about that. Remember, the Bible, when it specifies what is abolished, it's always talking about the law of Moses in specific. And when it refers to the law, generally it's referring to the law of Moses. The first testament, the first covenant, the old covenant, all those things refer to the law of Moses. But he was incorrect when he said that I have abolished parts of the Old Testament, such as unfulfilled prophecies, all that is in the Psalms, and in the Proverbs, and we've already talked about that. All that stuff is not abolished. The law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms, they all spoke of Christ, and He fulfilled all that was written of Him in them. Let's look in Luke 24, 25 through 27. Luke 24, 25 through 27. So Christ did fulfill all that was written of Him in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms. And the whole Bible, whatever was written of Christ, He did fulfill. Luke 24, 25 through 27. Then said He unto them, O fools, and slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken, ought not Christ to have suffered these things and to enter into His glory? And beginning at Moses and all the prophets, He expounded unto them in all the scriptures the things concerning Himself. Verse 44, And He said unto them, These are the words which I spake unto you while I was yet with you, that all things must be fulfilled, which were written in the law of Moses and in the prophets and in the Psalms concerning Me. And remember, we looked in the very first study that those are the three divisions of the Old Testament, the law, the prophets, and the Psalms, or the writings. And all of them spoke of Christ. And all of them are referred to as the law. And we've covered that before. The Psalms are called the law. Jesus quoted them. Quoted Psalm, I think it was 84. Or 82 maybe it was. And the prophets are called the law. Remember Paul quotes in 1 Corinthians 14. He quotes the book of Isaiah and he calls it the law. So the law, the prophets, and the Psalms are all considered the law. Parts of the Old Testament, such as unfulfilled prophecy. I've already said all this stuff. Unfulfilled prophecy of the second coming, the historical accounts, much of the Psalms and the Proverbs are not abolished, but the law of Moses most definitely is. So I don't really have a whole lot of disagreement, really, with Mr. Rivera there. The problem is, what he does is, he goes back and says, the Psalms and the Proverbs and so on are not abolished, and he would say, therefore, we ought to have musical instruments because it says it in the Psalms. And that's where the reasoning is flawed, because the musical instruments were peculiar to Israel's worship. God never gave instruction to the nations or anybody else about worshiping with musical instruments or anything. And for that matter, that was something that the nations did do. They did worship their God with musical instruments back then. So we don't necessarily just bring that over into the New Testament if there's no precedent for it. That part is done away. Okay, objection number 10. The Sabbath will be kept in the new heaven and the new earth. Kind of a clever objection. Say, oh, if it's going to be kept up there, obviously we ought to be keeping it down here, right? It's like the Sabbath has never ended. It started on the seventh day of creation, and it will go on into the new heaven and the new earth. Kind of sounds like a compelling argument, doesn't it? Look at Isaiah 66, verse 22 through 23. like I said, I'm thankful for my critics. They make me get in there and dig and learn. Isaiah 66:22 through 23. The Lord says, "For as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, saith the Lord, so shall your seed and your name remain. And it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, shall all flesh come to worship before me, saith the Lord." I think that's all. Yeah, that's all I wanted. Verse 23. So there, the Lord says, in the new heaven and the new earth, from one new moon, from one Sabbath to another, people are going to come and worship the Lord. So it sounds like they're going to have new moons and Sabbaths up there in heaven. That's what it says. Well, whether this verse is actually speaking literally of Sabbaths and new moons being kept in the new heaven and in the new earth, or whether it is merely using terminology familiar to the Jews to whom it was written, really is immaterial. Either way, I'm going to show you that either way, whether it's literally speaking of Sabbaths and new moons in heaven, or whether it's whether the Lord is using figurative terminology that the Jews would be familiar with to describe the new heaven and the new earth, either way, it does not say that we have to keep the Sabbath today. So the Lord sometimes uses figurative language when he prophesies the second coming and things. He uses language that Israel is familiar with at that time. So I am of the mind that it is using figurative terminology, and I will show you my reasoning for that. I do not think we're going to be keeping Sabbaths and new moons in heaven. And I think I have pretty solid reasoning for that. Okay, so first of all, there will be many things in the new heaven, in the new earth, which are not true of life on this earth under the New Testament. So even if there are actually going to be Sabbaths and new moons in heaven, that doesn't mean that we have them here under the New Testament. There's lots of stuff that's going to go on in heaven that we don't do down here. For instance, wolves and lambs feeding together and lions eating straws like bullocks. That will happen in heaven. Does it happen down here? No, it doesn't. Look at Isaiah 65 and verse 25. This is a prophecy of the new heaven and the new earth, not a prophecy of some future millennium on this earth where Jesus is reigning from Jerusalem, and that's what the premillennial dispensationalists will tell us. But this is a prophecy of the new heaven and the new earth. And it says, "The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like a bullock, and dust shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord." So, because that's going to be that way in heaven, does that mean that lions and lambs or wolves and lambs lay down together now? Do you see lions out there eating straw like a cow? No, that we don't have that here. So just to say because it happened in heaven that's the way it ought to be now, that is faulty reasoning. Now, there's no marriage in heaven. I don't think that whoever the clown was that gave me this objection would say, no marriage in heaven, there should be no marriage under the New Testament. I doubt that he would say that. I don't even remember who gave me this objection. This might have been Doug Batchelor, that Seventh-day Adventist. I can't remember. Luke 20, 34 through 35. Luke 20, 34 through 35. And Jesus answering said unto them, "The children of this world marry and are given in marriage, but they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels and are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection." Okay, so if you want to keep the Sabbath on earth under the New Testament because it's kept in heaven, go ahead, but be celibate for the rest of your life and get rid of your wife and stay here unmarried and be like the angels. So that's fine. You want to keep the Sabbath, remain unmarried. We'll compromise, 50-50 there. There's going to be no death, sorrow, crying, or pain in heaven. But does that mean that that's the state of things in the New Testament? I don't think so. If it does, I must be a basket case because I still have those things time to time. Revelation 21 and verse 4. Revelation 21, 4. It says, "And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away." It's going to be different up there. Thank the Lord. There's going to be no sun or moon or night. That's why I don't think there's going to be any new moons, because there's not going to be a moon. It's hard to have a new moon if there's no moon. You've got to have a moon to have a new one, right? All right. Look at Revelation 21. 23. This is the old reasoning that if an error proves anything, it proves too much. Revelation 21 and verse 23. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon, to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. So no need for sun or moon, because God is the light of it. And there's no night there. Look at Revelation 22 and verse 5. It says, and there shall be no night there, and they need no candle, neither light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. So that makes the possibility of them keeping the new moon rather unlikely if there is no moon. And furthermore, even if there was a moon, you would never see it anyway. You wouldn't even be able to tell it's a new moon because it's always light out. There's no night. You don't see the moon during the day, right?
Pastor, doesn't the Sabbath start at sunset?
It does start at sunset. There's another good argument. Didn't even think about that one. Good idea. But I have an answer for the Sabbath, too. Furthermore, it is unlikely that the Sabbath would be every 7 days in the new heaven and the new earth because there aren't days in the new heaven and the new earth. There's no time in the new heaven and the new earth. Revelation 10 and verse 6. And there's no evening for it to start on. You're absolutely right. Revelation 10 and verse 6. It says, and swear by him that liveth forever and ever who created heaven and the things that are or that therein are, and the earth, and the things that therein are, and the sea, and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer. You see, time is only for this world. Time is for this current universe. God, there was no time before God created the heaven and the earth. He created time. He deals with time, but he's outside of time. But eventually, he's going to destroy this thing, and there's going to be no more time. And it's kind of hard to even think about it, of a time without time, if you think about that. Think I'll be over there in 10 minutes. Actually, no, you won't. You'll just, I don't know how it'll work. But anyway, there's no clocks, no watches in heaven. You're never going to be late to church in heaven. You'll be happy about that.
Amen.
All right, but the fact remains that New Testament Christians on this earth living under the New Testament are not under the law of Moses and its commandments concerning Sabbaths and new moons. And we've already looked at Colossians 2, 14 through 17, because the law of Moses was abolished. You see section 5. We spent an entire Sunday talking about that. So I think I pretty well destroyed that argument. I like breaking things. It's kind of fun. Number 11. All right, this one is particularly absurd. And you've probably never heard this one. I hadn't heard it either. But people come up with all kinds of crazy stuff. In an effort to prove that Christians must keep the Sabbath and that church should be on the Sabbath on Saturday, it is alleged in Acts 27 that Paul met for church with the church in Troas and they met on Saturday evening. Okay, so let me say it to you again in English instead of reading it. Let's first of all go to Acts 20:17 and then I will give you the objection. That'll work better. Acts 20 and verse 17. I got this from Doug Batchelor, that Seventh-day Adventist preacher. Because the thing is, they have to do something with these verses that talk about Christians meeting for worship on the first day of the week. Because they say that we're still under the Sabbath, and under the Sabbath in the Old Testament, Israel met for worship on the Sabbath day. So we are still supposed to be meeting on Saturday. And don't you know that Sunday worship is the mark of the beast? We've all got the mark of the beast on us right now. I'm going to be enjoying spending the rest of eternity in a lake of fire with all of you guys because we've taken the mark of the beast worshiping on Sunday. That's what they'll tell us anyway. Acts 20 and verse 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together to break bread, Paul preached unto them, ready to depart on the morrow, and continued his speech until midnight. This is when Paul and Luke and his traveling companions got to Troas. There was a church there in Troas. I suspect that this church was started by the Apostle Paul. He started churches all over the place in this area. And more than likely, they did not have their own pastor yet, and that's why he met with them, preached to them for a long time, and then communed with them, and so on. So the objection is then that since we know that the New Testament Christians all met on the Sabbath, that apparently they were meeting for church on Saturday evening. That's what this was. So it was technically the first day of the week under the Jewish calendar, but they were on Saturday evening. Remember, because in the Jewish calendar, the days started in the evening, right? So Sunday actually started Saturday evening at sundown, and that was the first day of the week. The Sabbath would have begun on Friday evening, right? And then it would have gone on through all day Saturday and then ended on Saturday evening. So what they're saying is, when it says the first day of the week, they're saying Paul was meeting on Saturday night for church with them. That's what they're saying. There's a big problem with that. And you may have recognized it. If you haven't, I will show you here in just a minute. So they say that, let me just read what I have here, make sure I didn't miss anything. They say that since the days in the Bible began at evening, and since that they met on the first day of the week, Paul preached until midnight. This means that they were meeting on Saturday evening. And that's another aspect. He preached until midnight, so clearly they must have started meeting at night, and he just preached for, you know, a couple hours or something like that. That's the idea. This is nonsense for several reasons. Regardless if it was in the evening or it was in the morning, it was the first day of the week. If you use the Jewish calendar, if you use the Roman calendar, if it was morning, if it was evening, it doesn't matter when it was the first day of the week. That's what the verse says. Let's look at it again. Acts 20 and verse 7. And upon the first day of the week, when the disciples came together. Period, end of story. It was the first day of the week. I don't care how you try to slice it. I don't care what dating methods you use or time measuring methods. It was the first day of the week. If it was on Saturday evening, then by the Jewish calendar, it was still the first day of the week, right? Because the Jews' first day of the week started on Saturday evening. So if it was Saturday evening, it was still the first day of the week. You're not going to get around it being the first day of the week, which was technically Sunday starting on Saturday evening, not Saturday, which was the Jewish Sabbath. All right. The Jewish day began at evening, but the church at Troas was a Gentile church in a Gentile country. So more than likely, their days started in the morning and ended, you know, at the following morning, like our days do. So more than likely, they weren't under a Jewish calendar anyway, a Jewish time measurement system anyway. So more than likely, whenever they met on the first day of the week, it was probably during the day sometime. It wouldn't have been in the evening. It could have been, but probably not. There is no way to prove that they didn't meet for church in the morning or in the afternoon and continued until midnight. So the idea is that if they continued till midnight, clearly they must have started meeting at 9 or 10 at night or something, and Paul preached for a couple hours. There's nothing to suggest that. There's nothing at all to suggest that they didn't meet together in the morning right now and Paul continued talking until midnight. It's quite possible. You ever been to Brother Conrad Gerald's Basic Bible Doctrine series? Whenever he starts churches, whenever him and Pastor Boffy started the Cincinnati church, they went there and they preached from morning until night for 3 days in a row. 24 hours of preaching they preached there. So anyway, by that time, they had just beaten the people into submission. Yeah, we'll be, just make it stop. We'll get baptized, whatever you want us to do. All right, so anyway, it's not unheard of for a Baptist preacher to preach until midnight. And it's certainly not unheard of for the Apostle Paul to do it because he did it on other occasions. Look at Acts 28 and verse 23. Acts 28 and verse 23. For that matter, with Conrad, it doesn't even need to be a Basic Bible Doctrine seminar. He came to preach at Cincinnati one time, preached for 3 hours one evening. After 2 hours, Pastor Boffy finally stops him and says, how much longer are you planning on going? Well, I don't know, maybe another hour or two. And well, you've been gone for 2 hours. No kidding. Had no idea what time it was. Anyway. Acts 28 and verse 23. And when they had appointed him a day, there came many to him into his lodging, to whom he expounded and testified the kingdom of God, persuading them concerning Jesus, both out of the law of Moses and out of the prophets, from morning until till evening. So this was at Paul's hired house when he was in Rome. People come to him, and he preached all day long, morning till evening. So it's not a stretch at all to say that he met with the church in Troas there in the morning or in the afternoon, and he went the whole way till midnight. No problem at all. Now they say that if the Sabbath was changed to Sunday, which it is not, but they say that if it was changed to Sunday, and Paul met with the disciples on Saturday night, which he didn't, then why would Paul take a long trip the next day on Sunday? Okay, this is nonsense as well. So, I mean, it's just like error built upon error. They say if the Sabbath was moved to Sunday, which it's not, and they met on Saturday night, which they didn't, then why would he preach and then go and make a long trip on the Sabbath on Sunday is the idea. All right, total pure nonsense. First of all, the Sabbath was never changed to Sunday. It was abolished along with the rest of the Old Testament. We've already looked at that. 2 Corinthians 3:13, Colossians 2:14 through 17. You see section 5 for that. Secondly, Paul met with them on the first day of the week, which is Sunday. Let me just prove it to you. Sunday, definition, Oxford English Dictionary, the first day of the week. Just in case you didn't know that, Sunday is the first day of the week. So they met on Sunday, right? And he departed on the morrow, Acts 20 and verse 7, which would have been the second day of the week. If they met on the first day of the week and he left on the morrow, and let me define morrow for you, it is the day next after the present, the day subsequent to any specified day. The morrow, frequently used, equals on the following day. So they met on the first day of the week and he left the next day, which would be the second day of the week, which is Monday. No problem. Paul could go a whole day's journey on Monday with no problem. Even if the Sabbath was on Sunday, it wouldn't matter. Now, the fact that Paul held church in Troas on Sunday, which is the first day of the week, the fact is that Paul held church in Troas on the first day of the week, just like the other disciples did as well. Look at John 20 and verse 19. John 20 and verse 19. I mean, he was really doing some biblical gymnastics, trying to get around this fact that they met for worship and communed on the first day of the week. I'll give it to people. They are clever. John 20 and verse 19. Then the same day at even, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in the midst of them and said unto them, peace be unto you. What does Paul tell us not to forsake? The assembling of ourselves together? That's church. The disciples were assembled on the first day of the week, and Jesus comes to them. Jesus came to have church with them. So it wasn't just these Gentile disciples that were meeting on the first day of the week in Troas. The Jews, right after Jesus' resurrection, were likewise meeting on the first day of the week. But the fact is, we meet on Sunday, well, probably more out of, well, I don't know. I mean, there is biblical precedent for meeting on the first day of the week. There's biblical example of it. But there's also biblical example of the disciples meeting on every day of the week. They went from house to house daily breaking bread. So probably more out of just habit and tradition do we meet on Sunday than out of anything. But if I'm going to pick a day, I would pick Sunday anyway because we have two examples of disciples meeting on Sunday. But it just so happens that this is the weekend, people have off of work, and it just works out for us to meet on Sunday. But we can meet on Tuesday morning or Thursday evening. It doesn't really matter. We can meet any time we want for church. All right. What are these things called? Objections. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Objection number 12. It is alleged that Colossians 2:14 through 17, that's the one where Jesus nailed the commandments to the cross and took them out of the way. It is alleged that that verse is speaking of the rest of the law of Moses, not the Ten Commandments, which were written on paper, not stone, written by man, not God, and which was stored in the side of the Ark of the Covenant, not inside like the stone tables were. And all these things are true, right? These stone tables were stored inside of the Ark of the Covenant. The stone tables were the Ten Commandments. And I'll show you that in Hebrews 9 and verse 4. Hebrews 9 and verse 4. He's talking about the Ark of the Covenant here. He's really talking about the tabernacle service. And he gets talking about the Ark of the Covenant in verse 4. Which had the golden censer and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid round about with gold, wherein was the golden pot that had manna and Aaron's rod that budded and the tables of the covenant. So inside that Ark, you had, what, three things there. You had the golden pot with manna, you had Aaron's rod, and you had the tables of the covenant, the Ten Commandments, written in stone. They were inside the Ark. Then there was a compartment made on the side of the Ark, and that's where the rest of the law of Moses was put in. And this is true. Look at Deuteronomy 31 and verse 26. This is a pretty sly objection here, and I've heard this one from multiple people. If you ever get talking to people about this subject, you'll definitely hear this objection. And if you never heard it before, it might throw you for a loop. You think, oh, maybe there's something to that. Deuteronomy 31 and verse 26. The Lord tells Moses, take this book of the law and put it in the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness against thee. And they'll say that he took the law of commandments out of the way, which was against us, nailing it to his cross. Let's just look back at that verse again quickly in Colossians 2. And I will show you the argument here in the best detail that I can so you understand it. And then once I make you understand it, then I will destroy it for you. Colossians 2:14 It says, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us. And that's what the Lord said to Moses there in Deuteronomy 31:26. Put it there in the side of the ark for a testimony against you, which was contrary to us, and took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. So what the argument is that it was the part of the commandments, the rest of the law of Moses, written on paper, not by God, not by God's finger, but written on paper, that was put in the side of the ark that was against us. It was that stuff that was nailed to the cross, but not the Ten Commandments, and of course not the Sabbath commandment. And that's where this all comes down to, is the Sabbath commandment. So, they say that here's the argument, try not to laugh. They say that the Ten Commandments written in stone couldn't have been nailed to the cross because it was written in stone. You can't nail stone to the cross, right? So that's why it wasn't nailed to the cross. Okay, this is an absurd objection. This is nonsense. The Old Testament wasn't literally nailed to the cross. They didn't take out the stone tablets and nail them to the cross. They didn't take out the scrolls and nail them to the cross. It's figurative speech. It's nailed to the cross. It's taken away. It's abolished, right? But they Doug Batchelor actually made this argument. Well, you couldn't nail the stone tablets to the cross. Like, you could, they didn't nail any of it to the cross. Anyway, I'm not making this up. I'll give you the link to the video if you want to see it. I'm not trying to slander the guy. So therefore, whether it was the part that was written on stone or paper that was nailed to the cross is immaterial. It has got nothing to do with what it was written on. The whole thing was nailed to the cross. I'll show that to you. The handwriting of ordinances there in Colossians 2:14 was the law of commandments contained in ordinances, which Jesus abolished in his flesh. Look at Ephesians 2:15. We've looked at this verse before. Ephesians 2:15 says, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, even the law of commandments contained in ordinances, for to make in himself of twain one new man, so making peace. So Paul here is talking about the same thing in Ephesians and in Colossians. It's almost the exact same verse. Ephesians 2:15, Colossians 2:14, very similar there. But anyway, he says there, he identifies what he's talking about in Colossians when he says the handwriting of ordinances to the, how does he say it? The law of commandments contained in ordinances. So we're talking about the law of Moses here that was abolished and nailed to his cross. To abolish, as you no doubt remember, because I've read it so many times, is to put an end to do away with, to annul or make void, to demolish, destroy, or annihilate. Its application to persons or concrete objects is nearly obsolete, as it is usually said of institutions, customs, or practices. So therefore, Jesus put an end to and did away with and annulled and made void the law of Moses when he died on the cross. You can see that in section 5. So it was the whole law of Moses. It wasn't just the law of Moses that was written in paper that Moses wrote. It was also the law, the Ten Commandments, which were written in stone by the finger of God. And we've already looked at that. 2 Corinthians 3, 6 through 13. We just read that at the beginning of the sermon today. And you can compare that with Exodus 34, 28 through 35. And you put the two of those together, and it is absolutely irrefutable that it was the Ten Commandments written and engraven in stones that was abolished and done away with. All right. So, furthermore, if God wants to nail stone to a cross, he could certainly do it if he wanted to. The analogy doesn't break down with God. You know, not really a big deal. He could nail diamonds to a cross if he wanted to. All right, number 13, objection number 13. Oh, this is a good one too. I found this by some guy on YouTube. Somebody sent me a link to this guy, and he gets on there, and you know, he presents himself pretty well, and he just speaks with such authority. He's a young guy like me, but he speaks with such authority, you'd almost think he's right just because he seems so confident. But he's dead wrong, and I'll show you why. Okay, so it is alleged that Acts 15:21 compared with Acts 15:19 through 20, we'll read those in just a second. It's compared that those verses teach that the Gentiles will come to learn the Torah, that is the law of Moses, as they attend services on the Sabbath where they would learn to keep the rest of the law of Moses in time, but for the time being, they were only given these four commandments in verse 20. So let's read the verses here and you'll see what the objection is. This one is, admittedly, it was kind of a tough one. I had to think about this one for a while. It's one of those ones where you know that is BS. I know that's wrong, but then you're like, okay, well, what is that verse? What does it mean? I mean, I don't exactly understand what it's saying there, but I know that this interpretation is clearly wrong from everything else that I've compared with it in the scripture. But now I've got the answer for you. Acts 15 and verse 21. Actually, let's just go ahead and read verses 19 through 21. And this is what we read at the call to worship this morning. This is James's sentence. They get together. They want to determine what parts of the law of Moses do the Gentiles need to keep. And the Pharisees are saying they got to keep the whole thing. They got to be circumcised and keep the law. And they're there to determine if this is the case or not. And here is James's conclusion. Is it James's or just James' conclusion? I think it would just be James' conclusion, but I'm not sure how you say that. You guys should know. You got a James. You probably refer to James in the possessive from time to time. You should be able to tell me. Anyway, verse 19. Wherefore my sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God, but that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood. For Moses of old time hath in every city them that preach him being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day. Now, as you read that, you wonder, now, what is he talking about there in verse 21? What does he mean there when he says, for Moses of old time hath in every city them that preach him being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day? It is kind of a curious verse, and you think, well, what does it mean? Now, what this guy says it means is, well, hey, here's the deal. These Gentiles, they're not used to keeping the law of Moses. So here's what we'll do. If we try to throw the whole thing at them, here you Gentiles, here's 623 things that you better do and don't miss one. That's probably going to be a bit overwhelming for them. After all, these things are so heavy that we and our fathers weren't even able to bear them, right? So this isn't going to work. So here's what we'll do. We'll give them these four commandments, and that'll get them started. And then they're going to go into the synagogues, of course, on the Sabbath, and they're going to worship with the Jews in the synagogues, and then they'll learn the rest of the law of Moses as time goes on, right? That's the argument. That's what they're saying, verse 21 is saying. So they'll learn the rest of it as they go. All right. This is total nonsense, and it's arresting of the scriptures by Pharisees. Pharisees had crept into the church and had been teaching that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. Let's read about it in Acts 15, 1 through 5. It says, and certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except ye be circumcised after the manner of Moses, ye cannot be saved. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, they determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. And being brought on their way by the church, they passed through Phinehas and Samaria, declaring the conversion of the Gentiles, and they caused great joy unto all the brethren. And when they had come to Jerusalem, they were received of the church and of the apostles and elders, and they declared all things that God had done with them. But there arose certain of the sect of the Pharisees which believed, saying that it was needful to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. Now, what this sly dog does here that offered this objection is he says, oh, there were two things under consideration. The first one was the guys that came up from Judea and said that except the Gentiles were circumcised and keep the law of Moses, they cannot be saved. So here were some guys that were saying that they had to keep the circumcision to be saved. But then there were some other guys here that believed in verse 5, and they were saying it was just needful for them to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. So what he does is whenever they say, no, no, they don't need to keep the law of Moses and they don't need to be circumcised, what they were really saying is they don't need to do it to be saved. But they really still need to do it. So they were answering two different questions. I mean, this guy is sly. He really is. He's about as slick as Bill Clinton trying to convince you of heresy and error. All right, so, but here's what's going on. There's not two objections here. They're saying that these Jews that believed you had to keep the law of Moses, the whole point was that you had to be saved. You were justified by the law of Moses, right? In the book of Galatians, it was the same thing. They went to the Galatians and taught them that they had to be justified by keeping the law. So the keeping of the law wasn't just a ceremonial thing for them. It was salvation was attached to it. And the apostles here deal with the whole question. Whether it's salvation or whether it's not, do they need to keep the law of Moses or not? That's what they're talking about. Now the apostles and elders came together to determine if the Gentiles needed to do that. Verse 6, and the apostles and elders came together to consider this matter. And notice, what matter did they come to consider? Well, if you're going to say there were two different things, well, the last thing that was said was that the Gentiles needed to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses. It doesn't say anything about salvation there. The last thing it was said is that, and it says the apostles came together to consider this matter. So if you, even if you want to say there were two different things, what they were considering was, do the Gentiles need to keep the law of Moses and be circumcised or not? Now, Peter declared that the yoke of the law of Moses should not be put on the Gentile disciples, which none of the Jews had ever been able to bear, and that salvation for both the Jews and the Gentiles is through the grace of Jesus Christ. Let's look at verses 7 through 11. And when there had been much disputing, Peter rose up and said among them, unto them, Men and brethren, ye know how that a good while ago God made choice among us, that the Gentiles by my mouth should hear the word of the gospel and believe. And God, which knoweth the hearts, bear them witness, giving them the Holy Ghost, even as he did unto us. And put no difference between us and them, purifying their hearts by faith. Now therefore, why tempt ye God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? But we believe through the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ we should be saved, even as they. All right. So James's sentence was then that they would write to the Gentiles and that they would tell them that they only needed to keep those four commandments in the law of Moses. And those things were abstain from pollutions of idols, from fornication, from things strangled, and from blood. We read that in verse 20. So here are the four things. And you wonder, why did he only give them four things? Why didn't he say, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not commit adultery and covet and that kind of thing? And one thing that I thought of is that these four laws in the law of Moses wouldn't be part of the natural law. These wouldn't be things that the Gentiles would have known naturally, right? They know not to steal and not to kill and that kind of thing. But they wouldn't know about fornication. That seems kind of natural to most people, right? They wouldn't have known about that. They certainly wouldn't have known about eating pollutions to idols and things that are strangled and blood and that type of stuff. I mean, there'd be nothing innate in us, I don't think, that where you would just know that. So that's my thought anyway as to why they only listed those four things, because once the rest of the New Testament was written, there's certainly a lot of different stuff that we're supposed to keep, right? I mean, Christianity is not confined to those four laws there, but I would say that that's why they gave them this part. Or maybe that was a thing that was a really big deal with the Gentiles at that time. Fornication was a big deal, right? Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians about that, that the Corinthians had issues with that. And it was also a big, I mean, idolatry was a big thing in those days. And, you know, Paul talks about if you're invited to go into an idol's temple, to a feast there, and he tells you what to do. If they don't tell you it's sacrificed to idols, or if they do tell you it's been sacrificed to idols, you know, in one you can eat, and the other one you can't, and so on. So anyway, this was kind of a big deal, and I suppose that's probably why they gave him those four commandments right away. Now, the reason for sending the letters to the Gentiles detailing exactly which commandments they needed to keep was that there were synagogues in every city where they lived, where the Jews were teaching the law of Moses every week, and the Gentiles might conclude that they needed to submit to the law of Moses and be circumcised. Because remember, in those days, the Gentiles would go sometimes to the law of Moses, or to the synagogue, and hear the law read. Remember when Paul went to the synagogues and he disputed with the Jews, and then the Gentiles said, hey, we want to hear more about this? Well, the Gentiles were there. So here's what verse 21 means. Far from meaning that they're going to go there to learn the rest of the law, it means that at this time there were synagogues scattered throughout all these lands, all of Asia. So these Gentiles living in all these different places, there were Jewish synagogues there. They were more than likely going to come into contact with Jews. They would hear about the law of Moses, and they might think, and they might conclude, you know what? We probably have to keep all this law of God. That's why they said, okay, we're going to write and tell them to keep these four things, and here's the reason. Because more than likely, they're going to come into contact with this law of Moses, and these Jews are going to be telling me you got to keep the whole thing. That's what verse 21 is saying. It's asinine to say that verse 21 is saying they're going to learn to keep the rest of it. The whole point of the decision was they don't need to keep it. So far from saying that the Gentiles would learn the rest of the law of Moses in due time by going to the synagogues, the apostles rather wrote to them telling them, and I quote, we have heard that certain which went out from among us have troubled you with words, subverting your souls, saying ye must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandment. It seemed good to the Holy Ghost and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things, that ye abstain from meats offered to idols, and from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication, from which if ye keep yourselves, ye shall do well. That was verse 24, 28, and 29. So far from saying, okay, these guys are going to go, they'll go back, they'll go into the law or into the synagogues and they'll learn the law. Far from that, when they write the letter to these Gentiles, they say, there's guys out there telling you got to keep the law of Moses and be circumcised, and we never told them to tell you that. We gave them no such commandment. I mean, this is the worst interpretation of this passage that I could possibly conceive of. When I was watching this guy, I couldn't hardly believe it. The purpose of the letter to the Gentiles was to tell them that concerning keeping the law, and turn with me to Acts 21 and verse 24. Acts 21 and verse 24. This is in reference to keeping the law. So here Paul is. He's with these Jews that I referenced a while back when he's going to go into the temple with them and be at charges with them, and they're going to shave their heads and so on. They had a vow. Well, here's the deal. This is when James, in verse 24, James is telling Paul what to do here. Go into the law, be purified with these people, show these people that you're orderly and you keep the law. Acts 21, 24. Take them and purify thyself with them and be at charges with them that they may shave their heads and all may know that these things whereof they were informed concerning thee are nothing, but that thou thyself also walkest orderly and keepest the law. Okay, so James is telling Paul, go here and show these Jews that you still keep the law because you're still a Jew. Okay, that's what he wants them to do. Now look what James says in verse 25. As touching the Gentiles which believe. Now he's talking about Paul, a Jew, here keeping the law. As touching the Gentiles which believe, we have written and concluded that they observe no such thing. No such thing as what? Keeping the law. They observe no such thing. They don't keep the law, save only that they keep themselves from things offered to idols, and from blood, and from strangled, and from fornication. Do you see it? This is the same. This, when he says that we've written and concluded, this is what they're talking about in Acts 15. These are the Gentiles that they sent these letters to. And what did they tell them? They observe no such thing. You don't observe the law of Moses except for these four things. All right. I think I've thoroughly destroyed that argument, I hope. Verse 14. If I keep yelling up here, I'm not going to have any voice left. Not verse 14, objection number 14. This is from a guy named Brian Gives Glory to Jesus on YouTube. That's his handle. He says, the seventh day God rested and blessed it because the Ten Commandments were given to Moses. Why wouldn't all Christians want to remember God's rest, the only day he blessed and hallowed? It doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't we remember this special day? So here's his argument. Basically, God, he worked for 6 days, and then God rested on the seventh, and then God commemorates that day and tells the Jews to keep this day holy and so on. Why wouldn't we still want to commemorate that seventh day of rest today? Why wouldn't we still keep the Sabbath, is his argument. Well, he's kind of right in a way. We do want to commemorate that day, and we do commemorate that day, but not in the way that he thinks. We do remember the day on which God rested. How do we do it, though? By believing the gospel, ceasing from our own works, and entering into rest. That's how we remember it. It's not a matter of should we remember it or should we not. It's how should we remember it. Look in Hebrews 4, 3 through 4, and 9 through 11. Hebrews 4, 3 through 4, and 9 through 11. Paul says, for we which have believed do enter into rest. As he said, I have sworn in my wrath, if they shall enter into my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. For he spake in a certain place of the seventh day on this wise, and God did rest from the seventh day of all his works. So here we're talking about, Paul's referencing the seventh day when God rested, and he's telling us, here's how we enter into rest. And it's not by lounging around on Saturday and not doing anything. Verses 9 through 11. There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God. For he that is entered into his rest, he also hath ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us labor therefore to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. Paul says, you want to enter into that rest? Guess how you do it? It's by laboring to enter into the rest. The laboring is the belief. Right? They which had believed do enter into rest. And he says, let us labor therefore to enter in. Put it together. Belief is laboring. Belief is a work. Remember the work of faith, it's called? So this is how we remember that day. We believe the gospel. We enter into rest. We quit trying to save ourselves. We quit trying to keep the law, including the Sabbath, and we enter into rest. Jesus said, "Come unto him, and we shall get rest." Look in Matthew 11, 28 through 29. Matthew 11, 28 through 30, 28 through 29. Jesus said, "Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and ye shall find rest unto your souls." Now Jesus' yoke is easy and light, verse 30, unlike the law of Moses, including that Sabbath commandment, which was heavy, hard and heavy. Look at verse 30, Matthew 11, 30. "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now, if somebody says, "Well, Jesus is talking about keeping the Sabbath here." Now, wait a minute. The yoke and the law of Moses were not easy and light. Jesus is contrasting. There's something different here that he's talking about. Go back to Acts 15 and verse 10, which we were just looking at a minute ago. Acts 15 and verse 10. Remember what Peter said about the law of Moses? Peter was happy to not have to keep that thing anymore. Acts 15, 10, "Now therefore, why tempt ye God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear?" Yep, there's the difference between the yoke of the law of Moses and Jesus' yoke. One is easy and light, one is hard and heavy. All right. Objection number 15. It is alleged that Hebrews 4:9 teaches that we are still under the Sabbath commandment today. I'm basically just going to refer you to what I just said. But let's read that verse, and then I will refer you to what I just said. Hebrews 4 and verse 9. It says, "There remaineth therefore a rest to the people of God." They say, see, there still remains a rest. That means the Sabbath still remains. Look at what he says. "For he that has entered into his rest has ceased from his own works, as God did from his. Let us therefore labor to enter into that rest, lest any of you, any fall after the same example of unbelief." People that enter into rest are the ones that cease from their own works. That's what I just said. So basically those two objections are almost the same thing. So you enter into that rest by believing the gospel, by believing on Jesus and taking his yoke upon you. And finally, the last objection, number 16. Paul said that faith doesn't make void the law, but establishes it. I left this one for last because, quite frankly, it was the hardest one, I thought. Or at least at the time, it seemed like it anyway. I hope I can give it to you in a way that makes sense. In Romans 3 and verse 31, it says, "Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid, yea, we establish the law." So the argument is there, when Jesus came and he gave us faith and he brought the New Testament, that didn't make void the law. It established it, made it firm. We're still under the law. Is that what that's saying? Well, the verse actually has nothing to do with us keeping the law. It really doesn't. The law declared that everyone who didn't keep it in its entirety was cursed. Look at Galatians 3 and verse 10. Just try to keep all these thoughts in your head. I'm going to link them together. Galatians 3 and verse 10. "For as many as are under, or as are of the works of the law are under the curse, for it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them." So the law declared that everybody that didn't keep it in its entirety was cursed. Now the law witnessed that the righteousness of God was outside of itself. It was without the law. Romans 3 and verse 21. Romans 3, 21. "But now the righteousness of God without the law," that means outside the law, "is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets." The righteousness of God no longer comes by the law. It's outside of the law. There's something else besides the law that gives us the righteousness of God. And guess what? The law witnessed that. The law told us that there's going to be something besides this law that's going to make us righteous. The law witnessed of Jesus Christ who would come and make us righteous, right? Righteousness is no longer by the law. It's outside of it, and the law pointed to that. The righteousness of God is by the faith of Jesus Christ. Look at the next verse, verse 22. Here's what it is. Let's read verse 21 and 22 together. But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ unto all and upon all that believe, for there is no difference. There's how righteousness comes. It's by the faith of Jesus Christ, and the law witnessed that. You see it? It was Jesus' faith in flawlessly keeping the law, not us keeping the law, which justified us. Look at Galatians 2:16. We've been over this verse lots of times in the problem text study. We've covered it many times. Galatians 2:16 says, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by the faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Jesus Christ that we might be justified by the faith of Christ and not by the works of the law, for by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. So we're no longer, not only do we no longer get justified by the law, nobody ever got justified by the law. Nobody could have kept that thing. It's by the faith of Jesus Christ. It's by Christ's faith to come and keep that law flawlessly and fulfill all the work that the Father gave him to do. Go to that cross, believing that God would not leave his soul in hell, neither suffer his Holy One to see corruption, that he would raise him from the dead. By the faith of Christ, keeping that law for us, he made us righteous. And the law witnessed that that's the way it was going to happen. It was going to happen by a means outside of itself. Now, the fact that Jesus' faith alone made us righteous establishes the law. To establish means to render stable or firm. So the fact that Jesus' faith alone made us righteous establishes the law. It makes the law firm, which witnessed that it was impossible for righteousness to be attained by keeping it. The law said it's impossible for you to be righteous by keeping this thing. The law also said that somebody else is going to come and keep it for you, Jesus Christ. When Jesus comes and establishes faith, it establishes that law. It shows that law to be firm and stable, that the law was right all along. The law was right that you could never keep it and become righteous, and the law was right that it witnessed of Jesus Christ who would keep it for you. That's how faith establishes the law. Far from saying that faith establishes the law in the sense that we're still under the law, it's just the opposite. Faith doesn't tell us we're still under the law. Faith says that the law has been fulfilled by Jesus Christ. That's what faith says. Let's look at Romans 3:21 one more time. Now the righteousness of God without the law is manifest, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. And here it is. Let me show you that the law, that Paul said the law could have never justified us. Galatians 2:21 says, I do not frustrate the grace of God, for if righteousness come by the law, then Christ is dead in vain. If you could become righteous by keeping the law, there was no need for Christ to come. His death was totally meaningless and totally useless because you could have done it on your own. You didn't need him. Galatians 3:21. Is the law then against the promises of God? God forbid. For if there had been a law which could have given life, verily righteousness should have been by the law. If the law could have done it, God would have just gave you a law and said, just do this and you'll have eternal life. It could never do it. Jesus had to come and do it for us. So verse 31, Romans 3:31, do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid. Yea, we establish the law. We don't make it void. We establish it. We show it firm and stable. We can look back and look at that law and say, yep, this law was absolutely right. No man could keep it. Christ would have to come and keep it for us. And we've established that law as absolutely true and righteous and right. But it certainly doesn't establish it to say that we're under it today. Christ came and put that thing away. It's all over. All right, so that is the conclusion of this study. So let me just see if I can recap some of it for you just in review. Remember that when we talk about the law of Moses, we're talking about the old covenant, the old covenant, the Old Testament, the former covenant. That was the law of Moses. That was given to Israel and only to Israel for a specific period of time. It was given from Moses until Jesus Christ. It said, wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. It was added until Christ. Christ came. He lived under that law. He perfectly fulfilled it. He wrote a New Testament in his blood. We know that the last testament that a person writes is the one that goes into effect. Whenever he died, the New Testament went into effect. The Old Testament became null and void. It was abolished. It was put away. It was done away. It vanished away. Those are all things that the Bible tells us about it. Whenever that law is then put away, that means that we are under none of it, except what parts of it that are brought over again into the New Testament. And we looked at that. We looked at 9 of the 10 commandments, all but the Sabbath, are brought over into the New Testament. Therefore, those are all binding. We looked at other commandments like fornication and sodomy and idolatry. Well, that one is in the 10 commandments, but some of those other ones, incest and so on, a whole bunch of things, hatred and drunkenness and all kinds of laws that are brought over from the old into the New Testament. We're under those laws today. But we're not under laws like the dietary law, like the new moons, like the Sabbath, like the musical instruments in church, like all those things in the Old Testament. We're not under that stuff because it's not repeated again in the New Testament. We're also under things that the nations at large were judged for not keeping, like those, like sodomy, like incest, like adultery, like those types of things in Leviticus 18. Those things are universal laws for all mankind, and we looked at that. So we're still under that stuff because we've always, all mankind have always been under those. They're called natural laws. And then lastly, we looked at what the New Testament, we looked at the Psalms and the Proverbs. We looked at that. We showed that all that stuff is not abolished because we can, those things were written aforetime for our learning and for our comfort, that we can have hope. And then we looked at what we use the New or the Old Testament for, and we saw that it is very useful for fulfilled prophecy, which all these prophecies of Christ, which are fulfilled in the New Testament, all those prophecies are number one, excellent proofs that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. They're also excellent proofs that the Bible is the Word of God, because God called these things hundreds of years before they came to pass. What else did we see? We saw that the law was good for being a commentary on the New Testament. When we find a specific law in the New Testament, we can go back to the Old Testament if we can find the same law given, and there's usually a lot of information given there, so we can get examples and such. It's also good to see examples of human nature, how the Old Testament saints lived, how God related with them, how God judged them for sin, and so on. So we can get a lot of examples and admonition from there. That's what it says in 1 Corinthians 10. And then lastly, we covered some of the objections to it. So I hope this has been a beneficial study for you. I know it's been enjoyable for me and beneficial for me, and I have a better handle on it now than I did before, thanks to some of my adversaries that offered all these objections for me. So thank you for your kind and patient attention.